At the Milwaukee Art Museum, I had a real artistic weekend in Milwaukee going to the beautiful Art in Bloom show, which I look forward to every year. It's just beautiful with the flowers matching the paintings. And then to the exhibit of Nature and the American Vision, the Hudson River School, and then to the Milwaukee Rep, actually, to see American Song, which we're going to talk with James DeVita next week on this show. It's an incredible performance and a very important play, so I hope you have a chance to see that before we talk with him next week. So today we're talking about this exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It's from the New York Historical Society. It runs through May 8, and it is 50 masterpieces. We'll be talking about the rise of the Hudson River School, the nation's first original artistic movement, who formed this, and what we're seeing when we see this new exhibit, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Brandon Root is with us. Brandon is curator of American and Decorative Arts, and he is the curator for this Nature and the American Vision exhibition. And we thank you so much for being with us. It's really pretty, isn't it? It's really a beautiful exhibit.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure, Brandon. Let's talk first about the Hudson River School, the nation's first original artistic movement. Who started it? Why was it started? And what was its mission?
Well, it really started in the first decades of the 19th century, and this is when the nation started to emerge as a world power. It came off the War of 1812, which ended in 1815, and the nation began to flex its military muscle, its financial muscle. Maritime trade was increasing. But the one thing that the country lacked was an original Anglo-European artistic movement. And artists and critics kept questioning, well, if America is such a great nation, why does it lack these cultural institutions? Why does it lack an Anglo-European artistic movement? Mm. What is the art system? And the question that was posed, the answer that always came back, what made America original, what made it new, what could make its art different, was the landscape, the wilderness. Mm-hmm. This is what was unique, especially to America. So many of these artists actually began to travel to these various different sites outside of New York City, up the Hudson River, to the Adirondacks and Catskills, even as far then, which of course was an arduous journey to Niagara Falls and to the White Mountains in New Hampshire, and depict the natural landscape, depict the American wilderness, and use this as a vehicle to establish America's artistic credentials, but also to create political messages about where America was going and what its place in the world was.
Mm. And what were the political messages?
Well, it had a lot to do with American history, where the country had been in terms of the indigenous population, untamed wilderness, the uncultivated wilderness, and issues of settlement. This began around 1825, is the first sketching trip that Thomas Cole took up the Hudson River. And Thomas Cole is generally considered the founder, the father of the Hudson River School movement, this idea of going out and painting America's wilderness. And so he in particular began to question, well, what does settlement mean? What does cultivation of the land mean? What does industrialization mean to the American landscape and to the American people? And you can go through the paintings and many of the paintings in the exhibition and look at these subtle clues that Thomas Cole was leaving behind in terms of questioning these things.
Mm-hmm. And was that was it coupled then with, essays that were written, or was it coupled with poetry that went with the paintings that had a political purpose?
Oh, absolutely. And that's a great question, because this was a movement not just centered around the fine arts, studio arts, painting, but also involved literature and poetry. We think of perhaps best known Washington Irving and James Fenimore Cooper. They were all setting their stories in the Hudson River Valley and in upstate New York. And again, using these stories as kind of a springboard to comment on American culture and American politics at the time.
Well, that's interesting.
Cole was great friends with William Cole and Bryant, and Bryant wrote poems especially about Thomas Cole and about many of his paintings. Just as Cole would often incorporate poetry into the display of his paintings, and he also wrote his own essays on landscape and landscape painting, and presented his paintings next to poems.
And one of the signature works in the whole exhibit is Thomas Cole's epic, The Course of Empire. Can you talk a bit about that, why it's so important?
Absolutely. Its importance is difficult to overstress. These were considered, at the time, the greatest works of art that the United States had produced. This is essentially what did put America on the cultural map. And this is essentially the culmination of Thomas Cole's philosophy and thinking. He started thinking about these in the late 1820s, actually, when he made his first extended European trip, went back to England where he was born, and then to the continent. And it was finally in 1833 that he began them in earnest, because he was able to interest one of his patrons, Lumen Reed, in this series of five paintings. And what he did was create a cycle of five paintings that showed different times of day, the same landscape, but through the development of human history. To Cole and many of his colleagues and followers, cyclical theory was law. And this meant that civilizations were born. They rose. They had a culmination. Then they declined. And then there was a desolation. And so Cole follows this path, this cycle, from the first painting, what he called the Savage State, which shows this just amazing, brilliant, wild, untamed wilderness with the very elemental, elementary forms of our civilization, to the Arcadian State, which to Cole was like the perfect condition of humanity, the development of religion, of the arts, of the sciences, but also civilization and economy, maritime trade, to the middle painting, the third one in the series, called The Consummation of Empire. So this absolutely mesmerizing grand empire that this civilization has created. And, of course, to Cole's mind, this civilization died. And you see in the fourth painting, destruction. This society has been invaded. There's an invading army. There's pillaging and looting. Buildings are being burned. And then finally, you go to the last painting, Desolation, and this city, this great city-state, this great empire lies in ruins. It's been utterly destroyed, and you see barely any kind of movement or human condition, with the exception of a few birds having made nests. But otherwise, nature has taken over. And Thomas Cole's message was a few. Again, to Cole, nature, wilderness, is what made the nation so special. And if this was overtaken by a grand empire, by all these monuments to man, these buildings and whatnot, then it was inevitable that it would fall. But to Cole, what he wanted to do was question, is America exceptional? Does American democracy make this necessarily inevitable, or will American democracy break that cycle? And he also wanted to add a cautionary tale about the presidency of Andrew Jackson, who he saw as dangerously autocratic.
Oh, my gosh. He had a full plate, didn't he? Wow.
He certainly did. He was a brilliant man, always thinking, and the level of detail in these paintings, just to stop and really go through slowly and pick out all these things, is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. So when these artists went along the Hudson River and did Niagara Falls, or the second generation went to Europe and looked at all of these magnificent places in the natural world, were they bringing along paintbrushes, Brandon, or did they just sketch them and then come back to New York and spend years painting, or how did they do it?
Another great question. It was a combination of things. Many of the paintings you'll see in the exhibition are these grand panoramas, these really large canvases, what they called at the time exhibition pictures. And these were paintings done specifically to dazzle an audience, to be put on view in a gallery or a museum or in some cases a private home, but then the visitors to that home would absolutely be overwhelmed by seeing these paintings. I think the Albert Bierstadt, this almost 12-foot-wide canvas in the frame, perhaps best speaks to that in the exhibition. But they weren't painting these on site, of course, and then the idea of painting from nature is much more kind of second half of the 19th century concept. But what these artists did was take their sketch pads, their pens, their ink, their pencils, and they would sketch elements from nature. And occasionally they would also paint from smaller canvases directly from nature, these rough sketches. And then they would go back to their studios and kind of piece these different elements from the landscape together to create these grand exhibition canvases.
They're all in such beautiful shape. The colors in them are extraordinary. How do you keep something looking so good for 200 years?
Well, it is kind of an amazing thing, but I think one of the advantages is that this is the best collection of its kind in the world. The New York Historical Society really has the best material of the Hudson River School in its collection, and part of the reason for that and part of the reason why the paintings are in such great shape is that these, almost from the beginning of their lives, entered the collection of the New York Historical Society. The society was formed long before the Met or these other more famous museums in New York City, and was essentially the first gallery of fine art in the city. And so, for example, the Thomas Cole Course of Empire. These were completed in 1836, and unfortunately, Lyman Reed died before he could take possession of them. So they passed only briefly to his family, and then they were transferred to what was then called the Fine Arts Gallery and put on permanent display there, and that, of course, became the New York Historical Society. So almost from the beginning, the patrons, the collectors of these works understood their importance and were giving them to the New York Historical Society, then as documents of the changing landscape of New York. And that's part of the reason why they've been able to stay in such beautiful, pristine
condition. Oh, they are. They are gorgeous. You have said that these extraordinary paintings overwhelmed 19th century audiences with both their beauty and their razor-sharp commentary on culture and politics. Let's imagine for a moment, if we could, ourselves being in 19th century America and a member of one of those audiences. Where would we see one of these paintings, and how would it overwhelm us?
Well, again, another great question. I think the Albert Bierstadt that I brought up earlier is perhaps the best and most obvious example of something like this. Again, it's just absolutely dazzling. As you round the corner and you see this 12-foot-wide painting, it's hard not to have your breath taken away just by the sheer size. Mm-hmm. But then as you get closer, you begin to unpack all of these wonderful details that are in the painting. And it has such a rich and important history. This painting was commissioned by Collis Huntington, who was the great California railroad baron. And he wanted a painting that would celebrate the 1869 completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. Mm. And so commissioned Bierstadt, who had made one of his many journeys westward and was in California at the time, to do this. And the two men actually hiked together into Yosemite Valley, so Bierstadt can make his sketches. He, of course, as per the process, turned these into smaller paintings, pieced together these paintings, and made this large monumental canvas, which he completed 4 years later in 1873. And when he presented it to Huntington, Huntington rejected it. He wanted nothing to do with it. Huh. And part of the reason is, if you look at the canvas, it is difficult to make out any reference whatsoever to the railroad.
Oh.
And if you look closely, you'll see in the right foreground, there's this series of snow sheds lining a hill. And these snow sheds, of course, were buildings placed over tracks in rocky areas to prevent, or at least to protect the tracks and the trains from rock slides, and avalanches of snowfall and that sort of thing. And that's the only tiny little reference to the railroad in this otherwise grand monumental canvas.
Hmm.
So after it was rejected, Bierstadt took it to San Francisco. He put it on public display. And many of these displays at the time involved draping the painting and then pulling back the curtain at a particular moment, having this dramatic lighting on it. Oftentimes you would charge people admission to see it, $5, $10, maybe as much as a quarter.
Hmm.
And this was part of the way that they kind of dazzled the audience in these very grand theatrical displays.
Hmm.
And for areas that many people had never visited, even if they were in California. And the final way that Bierstadt really kind of drove home the theatrics of the scene is he retitled the painting Dawn at Donner Lake.
Donner Lake.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Referencing this moment, in this very dramatic moment, horrible moment in American history mm-hmm. that happened a few decades earlier, but that was probably still fresh in people's minds.
Mm-hmm. So did this inspire regular Americans? Maybe they weren't artists, but they were hikers and they were adventuresome souls. Did it inspire people to start going to visit these places?
Oh, absolutely. These painters had a lot to do with the establishment of the national park system.
Oh.
We think of, again, Bierstadt in particular and these grand canvases is how people often saw, not firsthand, but through these paintings, what the Western landscape looked like. And it was through the efforts of these painters that either state legislatures or more particularly Congress began to set aside lands specifically for recreation, for leisure use, in perpetuity to be public lands for all to enjoy. And I think what's fascinating is you could go through the exhibition, look at many of these places that are indeed today national parks. There's a great painting by Thomas Hill, for example, just on the other side of the wall from Bierstadt. And you see these tiny figures in the foreground, and they're riding on mules.
Hmm.
And they're well-dressed tourists. These are people who have made the excursion to Yosemite to see it for themselves. And you can see this in earlier paintings of Niagara Falls and throughout the exhibition, people using these as leisure destinations, as vacation and tourist destinations.
Wow, they were really...
And in many cases,
yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to finish by saying, in many cases, these were also souvenirs. People who had made those early trips up the Hudson River on steamboat, on these luxurious trips, and they wanted a reference, a souvenir, if you will, of their time spent on the Hudson River.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they didn't realize all that they were doing. It turned out to be an incredibly important movement, didn't it?
It was absolutely important. Again, as you mentioned in the introduction, this was the first, considered the first original artistic movement on American soil, and really kind of helped develop nationalism and patriotism about American land on the one hand, but also acted as references or documents of particular sites, of particular moments on the other, and also kind of led political action, whether it was questioning current politics or movements for the preservation of the land or setting land aside for national parks and that sort of thing. What's fascinating is that this was not really a cohesive movement or school. It was this group of artists initially led by Thomas Cole and then some of his followers who were working in a particular style, kind of this topographical accuracy, fine detail, very finished, really trying to convey the beauty, the majesty, the different seasons of the American landscape. But like a lot of artistic movements, the Hudson River School name was coined later in the 1870s, and it was coined as a pejorative when this particular style began to fall out of favor.
Huh. Who'd have thought? At least it's back in favor in 2016, and has been for a long time. Brendan Rood is our guest. He is the curator of American and Decorative Arts at the Milwaukee Art Museum and curator of the beautiful new exhibit there, Nature and the American Vision, the Hudson River School. It's an exhibition of 19th century paintings from the New York Historical Society, and it runs through the 8th of May. Some of the most important artworks in the first part of American history, really. We welcome phone calls. You may just want to listen, but if some of you have seen the exhibit and want to talk about it, that would be A-OK. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's take some phone calls for Brendan. 800-486-8655 is our number. Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if Audubon comes from that school.
Oh, that's a really good question. To a certain extent, you could say that, yes, he did, because he inspired one of the artists and one of the paintings that's actually on view in the exhibition. He was not a member of it himself. He had come over earlier, and his travels were a little bit different, going across America and depicting, of course, famously the fauna for the lithographs that ensued. But there's a painting in the exhibition by Robert Havel. And Havel's name, if you recognize it at all, is famous because it was his family's company that did the lithographs for John James Audubon's many books and portfolios, The Birds of America, for example. And Havel immigrated to the United States at the urging of Audubon. And, in fact, he lived with Audubon for a little while in New York before he settled on the Hudson River and produced that absolutely mesmerizing view that you see in the second gallery of the exhibition. So Audubon himself not necessarily classified with these group of artists, but of course it's a pretty small world, and he did have a hand in its development.
Thank you, Kenneth, very much for your call. If you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. Did any of these people in the Hudson River School movement or any of the artists feel that they had done such a splendid job of presenting American wilderness and giving a face to the beauty of our land that they wanted to have a European showing? Was there a European showing?
There were European showings more individually. These were not humble people, but at the same time, they're to be much credited with the development of art in the United States. Thomas Cole's first trip up the Hudson in 1825 coincides with the formation of the National Academy of Design, considered the first and still the longest-running art school in the nation in New York City. So it was this moment, really, not just to create a particularly American visual idiom, but also to create an American system of art training and art sales and museums. While these artists were interested, yes, in depicting America and putting America on the cultural map, they, of course, did not turn their backs on Europe. Any artist who was worth her or his grain of salt would, of course, make the requisite trip to Europe to study the artwork, the museum, the landscape, and in particular, Italy. Because this was a veritable storehouse of Western culture, from its museums and art to its landscape and its classical ruins. And so this played a significant part in the introduction of these artists to European art establishments and European artists. And eventually, yes, many of them had taken their work over there and had exhibited it, and exhibited it in conjunction with European works or European poetry to kind of make those connections.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure we've covered this, but the importance of the Hudson River to America at the time that these paintings were done, Brendan.
Well, the importance of the Hudson River to the United States, again, can't be understated. And it's probably economically, financially what led to the development of this school. In 1807, you had the successful launch of Robert Fulton's steamship. By 1825, you had linked the Hudson through the state of New York to the Great Lakes through the Erie Canal. And then by the 1830s into the 1840s, you had railroads springing up. So it was these innovations in transportation, in the movement of goods and people. And the Hudson, of course, served as this major waterway into the port of New York from these various places, whether it was from the Great Lakes, whether it was up through New England and beyond, really kind of connecting these areas, and the fluidity of travel and traffic on the Hudson that allowed people more often to go up, and more people to do it as the middle class emerged as a result of these kind of economic changes and whatnot. They had leisure time and the money to make these journeys and see these sites themselves firsthand.
Hmm. I was amazed. I can't paint worth a darn. I wish I could, but I can't. But I was as amazed in many of these large paintings. You really get a sense of how huge nature is and how little bitty we are. But there are some paintings where they have just this little tiny dog. I love dogs. And I don't know how anybody could paint something. And it's so tiny. It's almost the size, less than, it's like your thumbnail. And you can tell it's a dog. You know, it just amazes me that somebody can do that, Brandon.
Yeah, it is amazing. I think that's one of the great pleasures of going through the exhibition, is just kind of slowing down and taking your time and looking at mm-hmm. all of these details. And again, many of these details served a message. So I know the painting you're talking about quite well. There's a great view of Niagara Falls, and you see the rocks in the foreground. And there's, in fact, even a gentleman there who's got his sketch pad as if about to create an artwork, and his dog is there. And this serves as kind of an important surrogate for the viewer who's looking at the painting. These people are acting for you. They're standing in for you, so that you are experiencing Niagara Falls through them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it also shows the domestication of many of these areas, even by the 1820s and 1830s. That this was a site of tourist travel and leisure travel, so much so that the wilderness, in a way, had passed. It was safe enough that you could bring your dog there. And you look beyond the foreground, you see these little boats skirting the very edge of the falls, that the falls themselves were tame enough that you could take a pleasure cruise around them. And these are these wonderful clues about the cultivation of the landscape and industrialization. Often you'll look at some of these small details and you'll see just a tree stump in the foreground. Mm-hmm. Someone has come through and taken an axe to this. And of course, this is a symbol of cutting down the forest, toppling nature to build the railroad or the Erie Canal, these things that propelled the economy.
Wow. Well, there's much more there. That's phenomenally interesting. Thank you so much. It's a beautiful exhibit. We urge people to see it. Thanks, Brandon.
Oh, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Brandon Rood, Curator of American and Decorative Arts and the Nature and the American Vision. The Hudson River School is right now at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It is beautiful, and it runs through the 8th of May. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, very close to the beautiful Art Museum. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1:00.